The homeless crisis in Los Angeles, no more evident than around LA's Skid Row. But before you turn this podcast off and turn away, you have to meet my guest, an LAPD officer who's been lovingly named the Angel of Skid Row. First, please welcome Officer Dion Joseph.
Hello, everybody. How are you?
Good to hear. Sitting there looking so nice in your uniform.
Oh, yeah. You know, I got the muscles bulging, you know.
Yes, you do. Which gym do you go to here?
Wherever I can find one.
And it looks like it. Yes. I'm so thrilled to meet you. We first met at an event about a year ago.
Yep.
But I'd seen your story on the news. And so when I saw you at the event, I had to run over and say hello to you.
Awesome. It was good to meet you.
Yeah. Okay. So welcome, everyone, to my podcast, Olympic and Bundy. I welcome my two guests here to my home right here at Fox 11. I'm news anchor Christine Devine. I just want to tell you about my story for seeing Skid Row. When I first moved to Los Angeles a good 25 years ago, I drove by and it was so absolutely haunting and heartbreaking and moving and scary. And you wonder, what can I do to help? So that's why I wanted to do this podcast. My second guest is Colleen Granderson. Colleen, what is your story with Skid Row?
First of all, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Her first podcast, everyone. We have to break her in, right?
My name is Colleen Granderson. I was down on Skid Row in 2006 with my children. And my oldest son was kind of ditching school. And so I decided I wanted to move out of my apartment and go down to Union Rescue Mission. So from
let me stop. You decided you wanted to move out of your apartment?
Yes.
And why would you want to go to the mission? Well, the mission does great work, but an apartment would seem more stable to me.
The situation that my son was in, it was not from what I understand from the people that from another agency, LAPD, gang unit. They had told me that it would not be advisable for my son to live in that neighborhood.
Okay, so you wanted to get your son to a safe place.
Yes.
Where he would not be around the influence of the gang in that neighborhood. Okay, wow. All right, so Officer Joseph, is that a common thing?
Well, it's unique for someone to want to protect their son so much that they'll leave their home to go to a shelter. A shelter, even though the shelter she went to is a wonderful organization, that's not an ideal place to raise a child. So to me, you had to have been going through a lot of hell to be able to resort to that.
Yeah. Wow. And Colleen, I'm so glad you're here, because I think any of us who've driven by anybody who's homeless, or we hear about them, or families living in their car, or we hear about the shelters, or if you've seen Skid Row, you wonder, who are these people and why are they there? And you're just one story of somebody who was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Everybody who's in Skid Row is not a bad person. You know, a lot of people in Skid Row get demonized and stereotyped. One of the things I hear when I try to tell people, hey, look, we need to open family shelters in other parts of the city and county, we hear we don't want those Skid Row people. Well, that's not true. Most of the people in Skid Row aren't from Skid Row. They're from your community. So it's really disheartening. It's one of the main challenges of not being able to get people to shelter and to safety, the idea that these folks are bad people. But here's the truth about Skid Row to me.
Okay.
There's four.
Lay it out there.
Four kinds of people in Skid Row like anywhere else in the United States of America. Okay. The first group are good people, law-abiding people, people who care. They're just disenfranchised, and nobody else will take them.
Can I stop you right there?
Sure.
I would not maybe have necessarily understood that until this past weekend, where I have two young men that I knew since they were like 8 years old, 7 years old, moved back to L.A., and we were going to meet up. I invited them to a little family thing, and one finally said, I want to come, but I don't have anything to wear. We didn't want you to know, but we're homeless. And I'm like, okay, now that puts a face on it for me. People that I know since they were little, they have jobs, too. They have jobs, but they're homeless. And I really spent all day talking to this young man. Where do you shower? Where do you charge your phone? What do you do at night? Is it dangerous? Why are you here? Why are you here? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I'm going to go with you on that about good people, maybe somebody you even know. So right. Let's go ahead. Number two.
Number two, you have good people who end up doing bad things. And the reason why they do bad things is because they're struggling with addiction. And when they're struggling with addiction, there's this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde effect. You know, when they're sober and they have an environment that's conducive to change, we find that they're educated, they're smart. Some of them are college graduates. Some of them have talent. Some of them used to have jobs, own businesses. And they just got on drugs. And because they were on the lower end of the socioeconomic totem pole, they end up falling faster than their more affluent counterparts and end up in Skid Row. But sometimes they do bad things because they're disenfranchised. They will rob you, steal from you, break into your car to satisfy their vice, you know. Then you have people who've made mistakes. This is your part of your criminal element. But if you give them a proper environment conducive to change, we find that they want to do good in this world.
So these are people who are not having addiction issues.
Yeah, they're just had criminal records. You know, they can't get ahead, burn all their bridges. But the problem is, you know, they're in an area where crime is constant and they have to make a choice. If I can't beat them, I might as well join them. And then you have the last group. These are just career criminals. This is just what they do for a living. And they come down to Skid Row and they prey on all three groups. And here's what it looks like juxtaposed to anywhere else in the United States of America. The good people have to look the other way so they don't become victims of crimes themselves, because as everybody knows, being a snitch is not a good thing. And it's really sad how that word has now been cast on good people just trying to report crime. For the good people who do bad things, the drug addict, they stay on the bad side longer, because how do you change when the drug dealer is standing outside the drug program and also inside the drug program? If we think of our favorite celebrity, where do they go to get clean without mentioning any names? They go to Betty Ford, Malibu, Passages, they're doing yoga, horses are running around, all to get them away from the temptation to fail. The people of Skid Row, our brothers and sisters there, can't afford that. For the person who's made mistakes with redemptive qualities, when the area is off the chain and it's not conducive to change, they have a choice to make. You know, look, I'm only getting $221 a month. I just got out of prison. I got to find quote unquote work. And that's not a good thing when you hear that, because the work is either abusing people, beating people up to collect drug debts for loan sharks, or selling drugs, which causes them to recidivize.
It's a vicious cycle.
And then the last group, the career criminals, they pull all the strings and tie law enforcement's hand and try to make us look like the bad guys for trying to stop it all by any legal means necessary.
Okay, so I think that we're missing a fifth element, unless they're lumped in here somewhere, mm-hmm. the mental health aspect.
Oh, we're going to get to that. Oh, that's...
Okay, sorry. Your list continues?
It never stops. That's the one group that's been the hardest challenge for all of us in law enforcement, fire department, DMH, all these wonderful groups that are trying to make a difference in their life. Years ago, we all know in the 70s, the answer to mental illness was to close down the asylums, right? And then you had one side who closed it down, and then you had the other side who sued so they could never come back. So the answer was to sprinkle pills on these individuals and release them into the streets and say, yay, you're free. Come and see us once every week to get a refill. Here's what happens to those individuals. Some of them fell into the loving arms of family members who tried to handle them. But you have others who end up in Skid Row. And here's what happens. When they're taking their prescribed medication makes them feel down. It makes them feel lethargic.
They don't want to be on it. You hear that all the time. People, I don't want to take the medication.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you got to understand, Skid Row is what we call lit or turned up. You can't be down in Skid Row. You got to be up and ready to fight, ready to do whatever you got to do. So they'll sell their prescribed medication to make enough money to buy the hard stuff like crack cocaine, methamphetamines, the things that make them feel up, happy, alert. Boy. And that's what happens to the mentally ill. See, we know being bipolar is not a crime. Law enforcement knows being paranoid schizophrenic is not a crime. But when those things meet drug addiction, it's a disaster. And now there's a chemical buffer between us and the actual crisis. And it makes it really difficult for law enforcement and other agencies to help them.
My guest today is LAPD Officer Dion Joseph, who works the Skid Row beat, if you call it.
Yep.
I'm exhausted already just hearing what you have just put out there.
Yeah, it's imagine what we go through, 21 years of trying to help and create an environment conducive to change so that the influence of great service providers there can be stronger than that of the criminal element. And right now we're in an era where we are not supported by the very justice system that tells us to go out and fight crime. And that makes it so heartbreaking for me, because I know we can make a difference down
okay.
there.
My head is spinning because I don't even know where to start. I think we need 10 hours on this podcast. So welcome to Libick and Bundy. We might be here a while. But let me go to Colleen here. Colleen, so as he's listing, he put out that list there of the different categories of homelessness. Mm-hmm. Where do you think you fell in that?
Most of them. Because when I was younger, my mother died when I was 3. Oh. And
very hard.
From what I understand from the family that I knew of, my mother was bipolar too.
Okay.
And later on down the line, I was diagnosed as bipolar. Okay. So for me, I had to own up to that and figure out a way how to raise my kids.
How many kids?
I have 6.
Okay. And did you have all the kids with you?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So I had to figure out a way how to raise my kids without people stereotyping me as bipolar. And so I had to figure out, okay, how to tell my son how to do this or how to tell my daughter how to do this. And, I mean, I had good friends that were around me. But then later on, as I explained to you, as my oldest son has got in trouble, and when we went down to Union Rescue Mission, I thought that my oldest son would be safe, but then he got stabbed almost close to the heart. Mm. And from there, after I got him out the hospital, he still wanted to run the streets. Well, Mr.
Okay, now this is the connection between the two of you.
Yes.
Okay, let's just go there. All right.
Okay.
I want to hear it all.
Well, the counselor that was at Union Rescue Mission, she kept saying, Colleen, I really want you to talk to this officer. And I'm like, he's going to be like the rest of them. So I think it was early in the morning, she came to me and she said, I don't want your son to go to school. And at that time, he had stitches still.
And how old was he?
He was like, I think, 15 or 16.
15 or 16.
So your oldest?
Yes, my oldest son.
Okay.
And so my oldest son said he wanted to go to school. And I was like, no, you got stitches in him. Stitches in your chest, right? So he said, okay. So apparently the staff tricked me and got me in the room. And when they got me in the room, here go this big officer. And I'm like,
the muscles.
Yeah.
Comes walking in with the muscles and the uniform and the badge.
Everything. So then my youngest daughter at the time, I think was 5 or 4. And the counselor asked me and my youngest daughter and my other daughter to step out the room. Well, that didn't happen. My youngest daughter had went and opened up the door, and she said, oh, my God, he's sexy.
Oh.
I said,
I'm glad she said it, because I was maybe thinking it, but I didn't think it was appropriate for me to say it.
And so I told my daughter, DeJure, I said, what's wrong with you? She said, Mama, he didn't took off his shirt and his uniform. I said, Deja, did he actually take off his shirt?
And
she said, yes, Mama. I told her.
You took off your shirt?
Yes, I did.
Explain yourself, sir.
I was talking to him, and I wanted to try to get him to identify with me. He didn't see me as a fellow black man. He saw me as a big officer in a uniform who was there to intimidate him. And that's not what I'll do. I don't do scared straight.
It's hard to not see the uniform and the badge.
Yeah. So I said, you know what? Let me think outside the box here. So I took off my shirt. I took off my vest. And nothing was on but a tank top. And I'm sitting there. And I'm looking. I said, the only thing difference between you and me is that I made different decisions. I said, you're better. I want you to be better than your circumstances. You have a great opportunity to go to Utah and learn a trade.
Utah?
Yeah. Well, I'll let you explain that.
Oh, okay. Let me explain that part.
Well, how long are we going to be here tonight?
Okay. After after the incident with him taking off his uniform, his bulletproof vest and his shirt, right? Then my daughter said, "Well, Mama, I want to stay with him," right? I'm like, "Uh-uh, this ain't gonna work."
He's a married man.
Yeah,
he's a married man.
He's a married man.
Yeah, 5 years old is kind of young.
Yeah. Oh, she's a little one. Yeah. That's sweet. Now, okay, I see.
And so after that, we have did the process of trying to get my son in Job Corps, and then it went through, and then after Dion and the school collaborate together, we decided to put my son in Job Corps.
Okay, my father was a teacher at Job Corps, so I'm very familiar with the good works of Job Corps.
So after my son stayed there for several years and stuff, he graduated, and he's doing good. He's living in Utah.
Yeah. I didn't want to see another young black man lose his life. I'm tired of it. So I convinced him that, hey, you want to go back out here and run these streets and get stabbed again, or do you want to see value in yourself? Because you weren't born to fail or die. You need to take this opportunity, and thank God he did. And I was just glad to be there for both of them to be able to do that.
So you take off the LAPD uniform. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to do that?
Probably not.
Okay. Erase that, producer Oscar Flores. Rewind the tape.
No, it's okay.
No, keep it. Yeah, you know, I'm not ashamed. But you know what? The one thing I love about working for my department is they allow us to think outside the box to reach people. You'll be surprised to know that. A lot of things I've done is outside the box, and all I get from my department is, go for it, Joseph. If it could save lives, let's do it.
And you've been on Skid Row how long?
21 years.
Okay, so I'm just envisioning you there in your tank top talking to a 15-year-old.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now you look like you could be a guy at the gym.
Oh, yeah. And that was the point. And then at some point I put it back on and said, man, I love you. I said, forget about the badge and gun. You know, I put this uniform on because I love you. And I took it off because I love you, and I want you to see the value in yourself. And that meant a lot to him to do that.
You know, when you look at someone, did you feel the connection in the eyes? Was he looking at you and listening?
I always know. It takes a while. I used to be a juvenile investigator when I worked Newton Division, and I worked with a lot of very hardened kids. So after a while, you know, just my upbringing, you know, I was no gang member or anything like that, but I knew a lot of them. I grew up in the 80s where a lot of young black men were losing their lives. So you can kind of look in somebody's eyes and know when you're reaching them and understand how to take those walls down brick by brick until you get to the heart of the issue. And I got pretty good at it over the years.
And Mom, could you tell your son was listening?
Yeah, he was listening. He was like, he apologized to me for all his actions and what he's done. And I was like, you know, Mama's going to always love you, and Mama's going to always be in your corner. But when you're wrong, I'm going to let you know about it.
Mm-hmm. So he seized that lifeline. You gave him a lifeline.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So let's talk about Skid Row. What kind of numbers are we talking about? I mean, if anybody, our producer, Oscar, I'm just going to throw this out to you. He's fairly new to LA, right? Have you seen Skid Row? Have you been to Skid Row?
I have not yet.
Oh, okay. Baby.
Yeah, it's something I've heard about so much, whether it's in the media or you know, in films. But I just I have not been there, and it's on my list to visit and see what's there. I've always wanted to help out the community any way I can, and I wanted to see that for myself. I just haven't yet.
It is a haunting reality check. Colleen, how would you describe it?
Well, for me, it's like it's a learning. You know, I can learn. I am a police volunteer over 5 years, and I have graduated out of the Citizen Academy.
Congratulations.
I think over 15 times, I think she told me.
She really loves the Citizen Academy.
Great networking.
Yeah.
And I'm one of the clergies at our station, so I do multiple things in the station, and I feel like I'm doing a very good job.
I would think that you are. That's why you're here today on this podcast. Mm-hmm. Your first one. You're doing so great.
And that's the benefit of community policing. When we are allowed to show people who we are, not just what we do. And that can be hard to do. When crime is high, when things are bad, sometimes the only thing you're allowed to show you is what we do. And that's not because we hate the community. It's just we got to stop the bloodshed. But when we're allowed to do our jobs and make an area safe, we're allowed. And during that time, we did a really good job of that. We reduced crime in Skid Row about 40%. The blight was down. The quality of life was better. Less needles on the sidewalk. And we separated the wolves from the sheep. And I was able to, you know, figuratively and sometimes literally, take my uniform off and show who I am. And so was my fellow officers. And we really made a lot of gains in community policing. I mean, we have somebody who was homeless who is now a volunteer at our station. That says a lot about our efforts to reach out to the community.
I just want to paint a picture of Skid Row. And it's, how many blocks is it?
50 blocks.
How many?
50. 50 small blocks.
I don't know. When did it get to 50?
It's been 50.
Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, our division is a small division. It's 4.5 miles of territory. And in the heart of it is Skid Row. And Skid Row often accounts for anywhere from 40, or depending on the season, it could be anywhere from 40 to 55% of all of our crime. So you can imagine it's pretty bad. Now, why does Skid Row exist? It's a recovery zone. It's called a recovery zone because there's 108 programs designed to help people with a myriad of issues, whether it be mental health, housing, whether it be domestic violence. Hope is a trip and fall away. The only thing Skid Row can't do, like anywhere else, is house everybody. But because its residents are from South LA, Watts, Compton, Long Beach, Inglewood, Pasadena, sometimes when the disenfranchised folks that come there because they can't go anywhere else, the negative element follows them in, knowing that there's drug programs, knowing that there's drug addicts. So let's go down there and prey on it. And we have hundreds and hundreds of gang members and loan sharks and pimps and human traffickers who descend upon Skid Row and prey on the men and women of Skid Row trying to get their lives back. And the environment has always been the perfect guise for them, you know, and they'll use the tents, they'll use the shopping carts, they'll use...
Blend in,
and they'll take over every block. They control pretty much every block, and they've even charged homeless people their entire Social Security checks just to stay on the sidewalk.
Okay, this is depressing, that picture you just painted.
Yes.
How do you keep going? I mean, I can't believe you haven't been transferred out. I'll go somewhere. I'm going to go.
You know
I'm
what?
I'm out.
They have tried.
When I first got to Skid Row in 1997, that's exactly what I said to myself. So I got to get the hell out of here. I can't help these people, because when I came on a job, of course, you want to help. I said, I can't stop this. But after about spending 3 months and actually being assigned to Skid Row Car, you know, I realized several things were happening. These people weren't getting justice because the world saw them as less than worthy. You know, the constant thing I would hear above our level was, it's just Skid Row. Why do you care so much? Mm-hmm. So we'd have people getting raped, people getting hurt. You know, their cases were getting rejected because they were drug addicts or homeless. And that broke my heart. And I said, somebody's got to be here for them. And also my upbringing, you know, was a part of it. My DNA, my mother and father raised 41 foster children.
We're going to get into that. Oh, you know, okay. My big thing is the kids in foster care.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
when
yeah.
I saw that, I'm like, uh-oh.
Yeah. Yeah. That plus my dad, he was engaged in a lot of crime himself. He grew up in the Jim Crow South, where they had literally no opportunities. You know, when people talk about racism now, I mean, I hear them, but they don't know what it's like right. to be told where you can and can't go. You know, and
which bathroom you can use, which fountain you can drink out.
Crosses burning on your front lawn, people lynching your loved ones. They don't know what that is. So he hired people who reminded him of himself, and he never called them his employees. He called them his friends, and they had criminal records. They were homeless. They were passed over because of race. And I learned from both of my parents what the love is.
Basically, the people of Skid Row weren't a foreign entity to you, a foreign concept to you.
Aesthetically, it scared the crap out of me. But then after a while, I realized I was home, and I could be anywhere in the city. I could be in Hollywood getting autographs. I could be in West LA sipping on lattes. I love the people of Skid Row. I love my job. Yeah.
And that's why I have you here on Olympic and Bundy. We appreciate you being on this podcast. I've got a couple of Skid Row stories myself.
Mm-hmm.
I do know there are amazing services at play down there.
Mm-hmm.
The Downtown Women's Center is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a group of news ladies who befriended that team.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they got their building for $1 from the city.
Mm-hmm.
It's a high rise. It's now apartments for women who've been on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And they serve lunch every day.
Yep.
We built the library there.
Good.
So we have the library. And, you know, the thing is, we get so many press books here at Fox 11
mm-hmm.
that when we're done using them for the show, the guests on the morning show, for example, you have these beautiful top quality hardback books that are perfect for that library.
That's awesome.
So that's one organization that's also, as you know, working mm-hmm. to make a difference.
Oh, yeah.
But how do you ever feel that, I mean, to me, it's overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where do you find and feel like you see a success?
Well, for me, it's overwhelming too. Imagine having my job where the system, the current system, the current justice system doesn't allow you to protect people in need. Imagine parking your car next to a tent and thinking everything's fine, and then the next day you look at a police report where a woman was violated by two men and she couldn't scream, and then you look at the time and realize you were parked next to the tent where it was happening at the time. If I can't see him, I can't save. So there's been many days where I said, oh my God, I can't do this anymore. But when you run into people like Colleen, when you run into people who you've helped, they've said, Joseph, it was you.
But let me ask you, let's go back to that situation about your car was parked right next to the tents, for example. Mm-hmm. What could have been done differently?
If you can't hear them, you can't go inside the tent, you know. So a lot of sometimes women get given drugs and they're drugged or knocked out, or they're drinking something and someone slips them something and they end up passing out, and they don't even realize what's happening to
women
them.
Who live on Skid Row.
Yes, yes.
And
oh,
even gosh. Even like Joseph says, even women that think they have been molested or whatever, they'll wait another day or so to file a police report. Or a lot of times they will even call me, okay? And I'll be like, did you make a police report? Mm-hmm. And sometimes they will say, well, oh, I'm scared. No, don't be scared. No, let me help you.
Yeah,
because they'll do it right away.
Let me help you.
You have,
I'll go down there and do it.
Yep. Because you have not only you have their Johns who threaten them, you have the gang members in the area who say, oh, and even the negative exception of advocates who say, if you go to the police and you tell them that you were a sex worker and you were sexually assaulted, they're going to arrest you. Or if you have a warrant, they're going to arrest you. And none of that was ever true. So we had to step up to the plate and create programs like Ladies Night to let the women know, I don't care if you're a preacher, you know, I don't care if you're on the pole, on the pipe, or on parole, or undocumented. You can come to the police and report sexual abuse and domestic violence, and we will not criminalize you at all. And we really empowered a lot of women in Skid Row to come forward. But now what happened, that was years ago, but what's happening now, because the area went right back to what it was before, now we're back to where, even though you don't see a lot of rape reports on our map, it doesn't mean that a lot of women aren't being raped. We're there now where they're afraid to report it again because the gangsters and the criminal element has such a stronghold on the area.
And like we have done a lot of trust talks that I'm a part of and he's a part of.
Oh, yeah.
And like all the commanders and stuff will come out. And like if somebody has an incident or whatever, they'll either tell the officers or they'll tell one of the counselors at the trust talks, and then we'll go to the next step and figure out what to do.
So, Colleen, it seems to me that you found just great purpose.
Yes.
For yourself.
Yes.
You didn't leave the community. You didn't go away.
No.
You stayed. Why?
Because to me, for one reason I stayed is because Deion Joseph has always been in my corner. Okay. And before that, you know, I used to come down there and just leave and go do what I had to do. But then Deion and Captain Orb, they had told me, no, we got a plan for you.
Wow.
And they invited me to the Citizen Academy.
And all the stations have these citizen academies. I've gone through them myself.
Yeah. Yes.
So all the stations have these citizens academies to allow the citizens to be part of the community,
right.
Part of policing.
Right.
Yeah.
And what's unique about ours is we, and it's not to say everybody else excludes people, but sometimes, you know, there's background checks and things, which we do, and some people that really need to be at the Citizens Academy can't go because of their record. So the wonderful thing about our captain at the time was he was like, look, we understand there's certain people we can't let in, but some people, hey, let's lower the bar so they can come in, because these are the people, the element that doesn't trust us, that needs to be in here. So our Citizens Academy would be a good mix of people from Skid Row, from the Loft community. It was one of the most diverse, and it was really fantastic.
And which station are you at?
Central Division.
Okay.
The number one division.
Yeah, that's here for Central. Okay, so Skid Row is 50 blocks.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
And there's a concentration of services like Union Mission,
yes, mm-hmm.
like the Downtown Women's Center. Mm-hmm. I also worked with School on Wheels. They used
great
to have
program.
Yes. Yes, great program.
Did your kids go there?
My kids went through there.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
My
and
kids
School
went
on
through
Wheels
there.
Kind of brings school to kids who are homeless,
mm-hmm. right.
living in the shelters, living in the cars, living
right.
in the streets. They're amazing. Okay. Mm-hmm. So how many people would you say in 2019 are living on the streets in Skid Row?
Now, there's a total of about 15,000 who actually live in the Skid Row area, but there's about 2,500 or upwards of 2,500 people who actually live on the streets. And here's the thing, you know, most of them are homeless, but many of them aren't.
What do you mean by that?
They're simply down there because that's a place I can't bring my dope into my mom's house, so I can go home. I can go to Skid Row and nobody's going to mess with me. And I know this because on average of 5 days a week, I'll get a text. They'll hit me up on Facebook, Twitter, or they'll come to the station and say, have you seen my son or daughter? And because I know just about everybody out there, I can reunite people. And I pray in my heart they'll go home, but many of them say, thanks for coming to see me, but I'm not ready to go home yet.
Yeah, yeah. I had a friend do a little documentary on the homeless, and she talked to a man who said, you know, I want to do my drugs.
Yeah.
I want to do my drugs, and my mom, I can't stay at my mom's if I do my drugs, so yeah. I stay here.
Yeah.
And is baffling to me that people would rather be on the streets.
Absolutely. And many of them are shelter resistant. They're housing resistant. I've housed about 150 people over 10 years working with programs inside and outside of Skid Row, those partnerships that we were able to form. And, you know, a lot of people knew that if you needed a help or leg up, call Officer Joseph. You know, how come only 150 people came? Because the others weren't ready because of the environment. Some folks need a push, a loving, strong push to get them where they need to go. If you go hands off and just let them do what they're going to want to do, they're going to stay there and continue to destroy themselves. And, you know, and that push has kind of been taken away.
Meaning?
Meaning our hands are tied with the change in laws, you know, the change in laws regards to tents, can't enforce tent laws, sitting on the sidewalk. So now people, you know, they say they're just sitting on the sidewalk. They're not just sitting on the sidewalk. They're dying on the sidewalk, you know. And that's, I see that. I've watched for hours, rooftops. I've been there 21 years. I know what happens on the sidewalk. And without some kind of order there, mm-hmm. you know, they mainly stay.
And so you maybe have to clarify if I'm not saying this correctly. Basically, there was a lawsuit filed that stopped law enforcement from moving in and just cleaning up the tents with mm-hmm. a theory that that may be tent or trash to some, but mm-hmm. it's somebody's castle and their home
right.
to others,
right, right, right.
and you can't invade someone's home.
Right. And now as a result of that, once again, the criminal element has completely taken over, and the blight, the needles are back on the sidewalk. The kids we talk about that live at the Union Rescue Mission, now they have to walk through again and see people having sex on the sidewalk, needles everywhere, spice. Spice is a horrible, horrible thing people smoke, and it doesn't just affect the people smoking it directly, but even the fumes can overtake people and have an effect. Kids just getting contact highs, just walking down to the school and seeing things that no child should see. So, like I said, you know, for me, it's frustrating because I know what we're capable of. You know, we don't want to get rid of Skid Row as far as services. The services are needed. You know, we just want to make them better by, you know, separating the wolves from the sheep so the sheep can get better.
So let me just say this. You know, if I were doing a news story, I'd have the other side here to mm-hmm. talk about, you know, the concept of the tents and the laws. So mm-hmm. it's not a newscast. It's a podcast. So
right.
we're going to focus on what you're seeing out there.
Mm-hmm.
I know how to correct the homelessness crisis is a controversial issue. What mm-hmm. to do is a controversial issue.
Mm-hmm.
And you're seeing it every day, and you're choosing to stay and work there each and every day.
Right.
I do know the mental health issue really concerns me. Here's another story that I encountered. I mm-hmm. I was assigned a story about a month or two ago to cover L.A. Fashion Week,
mm-hmm.
and I decided I would take the train from West L.A.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take the train from Olympic and Bundy here and experience that, which was great. I had to walk several blocks to get to the location, so I'm walking. I thought, it's dark out now. Do I save the money on Uber or mm-hmm. and take the train? I'm going to try to make my way back to the train.
Right.
Well, I turned down the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, downtown L.A. at night, you turn down the wrong way on certain blocks. You've gone, you know, suddenly you're no longer at the fashion show.
You're in the Twilight Zone.
Suddenly it was pitch dark. All the businesses were closed. You know, they had those iron gates mm-hmm. that they pulled. All of a sudden, I started seeing a homeless person here, one there. One here. I saw an LAPD car drive by. I almost went, "Officer!" But they were like four lanes over, "Officer!" And so I said, "Chris, use your wisdom. Turn around and go back to." And okay, so I turn around. I start running, mm-hmm. and a homeless man. I run past him. He looks at me. He starts following me, literally looking like a zombie out of the zombie movies.
Wow.
Hands are like this, up in the air,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
like following me.
Mm-hmm.
Instinct had me jump into a little dive burger shop, and everyone looked at me like, what are you doing here?
Mm-hmm.
He's up against the window doing the hands,
right.
and I acted like I was a customer buying an horchata,
mm-hmm.
and I bought a drink, and I said, Chris, it's not safe. Call Uber. Now, that to me was a frightening story.
Right.
a frightening encounter, this man literally looked like a zombie.
Right, right.
What is that?
That could be a combination of either mental illness or just drug addiction, long-term drug addiction, or even worse, both. That's the biggest challenge we're having right now is mentally ill people who are dual diagnosis. And let me explain what happens to these individuals. Because they're mentally ill and they're using hard drugs, they deteriorate so fast that they make the perfect victim, but sometimes they make the most dangerous suspect. And that's not demonizing the mentally ill. You know, I feel sorry for them. When they strike, when they hurt people, when they do things that are shocking, I don't get angry at them because I believe that the system failed them, not us or anybody else. So I had a young lady in Skid Row, I won't give her real name. She's a victim in over 24 crimes in 1 year, but she's also a suspect in about 30 in that same year, you know? And to me, that's somebody that needs help. She doesn't need a 72-hour hold, which is not just 6 hours, which is not even 72 hours. It's actually six, and then they release them, and the cycle continues.
What do you do with her, though?
We just repeat the cycle. Legally, under the law, all we can do is when she, A, threatens to harm herself or threatens to harm others or becomes so gravely disabled to where she can't take care of herself physically or mentally, the only tool we have is 5150 of the Welfare and Institutions Code, where we take them to a hospital if our SMART team says, yes, they're qualified, and they're supposed to be there for 72 hours, but they get released in like sometimes 3 to 6 hours, and that's not helping them because, A, you haven't dealt with the problem, B, they're still addicted, and once again, the cycle continues. So it's failed. It's system. We're dealing with systemic failures that's been failing the mentally ill for years, and now it's even worse.
Well, I literally hoped that if this guy comes in this business to attack me, will one of these men jump up and protect me? I literally was like praying that somebody would do something if he entered the building. He didn't need to stay there at the window. Mm. Colleen, my question for you is, when you see things like that, how do you keep going and working with this community?
Well, on that note of what Joseph said, a little story. My daughter she went to McDonald's, right? And it was a homeless man. And she says, she didn't tell me, but she bought him McDonald's and bought him a coffee. And she came home and told me about it. And she said she felt good about it. And I said, well, why did you do it? She said, Mama, because I remember when I was down there on Skid Row. I remember how people treated me. So I want to treat him the same way. And I looked at her. I was like, wow. Hmm. From all that experience from us being down there on Skid Row.
And she's doing well?
She's doing well. I was like, wow.
Proud of her.
Yeah. She's like, working, has family?
Yeah, she's working and...
About to graduate.
From?
School? High school.
High school, okay.
And my thing is that if I can see another mother down there on Skid Row, another child down there on Skid Row, and if I can help them, I have no problem with it. Because I can tell them the experience that I have been through.
Yeah.
And everything has came out good for
me. So let me ask you both this question, because I think every one of us, whether you're driving through downtown or you're near Skid Row or not, we encounter the person who's homeless when we're near a restaurant. Let's say, do you give them money? Do you recommend you give them food?
Well, for me, the answer is no for both.
No.
You know.
No. Hard no.
Hard no.
No.
And here's the reason why. When I was a young man, I was very idealistic, very, you know, of course, the way my parents raised me was to be a giver. So oftentimes I would give my lunch money. I think I gave away a leather jacket when I was a young man. And I'll never forget, my oldest brother, he saw me give my lunch money when we were doing construction to a homeless man. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm just giving a brother something to eat. And I was like, what's wrong with that? And he says, get in the car. So 10 minutes, okay. We drove, and we found the man in the alley 10 minutes later smoking on a crack pipe. That was the first time I'd ever seen a crack pipe.
Oh.
He said, bro, there's your lunch money.
Oh.
And I was crushed by that. But I didn't want to stop giving. So I said, I'm going to stop giving money and I'm going to start giving food.
Okay.
And I was surprised at how many rejections I had from people saying they wanted money to get something to eat when I was giving them hamburgers and stuff like that. You know, so I started getting smarter with how I gave as a civilian. So single mothers who needed groceries, I'd do that for them. That was obvious. But now when I became a police officer, I realized that in Skid Row, nobody goes hungry or naked in Skid Row.
Because of the services.
Yes.
The missions serve about 11,000 meals every day. There's not 11,000 people in the streets of Skid Row. And they offset their hours to meet the needs of the community. The average person in Skid Row can eat four times a day. And it's not soup kitchens. That's not the soup kitchen concept, because in the mission there are programs and they have the food, feeding, and clothing programs to guide people into the services to get them on their feet. When we continue to feed and clothe the people of Skid Row in the street where there's plenty of services, they're going to choose the streets. You're basically incentivizing them to stay in the streets and continue to destroy themselves.
So I'm thinking of the Downtown Women's Center. I've gone mm-hmm. there to donate books during lunch hour, so I've seen mm-hmm. the lunch hour. Mm-hmm. So you're saying they're doing right because it's in the building. Mm-hmm. They're saying, if you want help, come in and have a meal, mm-hmm. and then they'll try to share services and
absolutely.
Let you know they have yep. services while they're there.
And also in a safe, sane environment instead of eating on a urine-soaked sidewalk, you know. And it's not knocking the people who donate. I think their hearts are in the right place, but I think they just don't know what else to do other than what they've done for years. So I never say stop helping. I say help in a responsible way. Don't bring food and clothes. Give that to the mission. Give the money to the mission. But bring hygiene kits. Do things that de-incentivize the streets.
Okay, so let me get into that just a moment. Because my husband and I, we all often debate, because he's the type, he'll always give the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the type, no, I want to give to known service programs.
First of all, let me...
Okay,
I'll piggyback off of him.
All right.
Since I've been down there, and I kind of knows what he's talking about, I've always learned that don't give them no money. Never give them no money.
Okay, now let's say we're not just on Skid Row. Let's say we're in Westwood, Beverly Hills.
Never give them no money. You can offer them food or offer them coffee or anything like that. Never give them no money. Because then when you see them the next time around, or they see you the next go around, then they're going to keep thinking they can have money. They're going to be wanting that money every time.
And there's a reason why they want it.
My hubby is convinced, though, look, if I can help someone out, they can use that dollar.
Please have them to come down to the station. We'll okay. give them a treat.
Well, I'll say to your husband that I want everybody to hear me. Pretend there's a sign over my head that says there's always an exception to the rule. That's true.
Okay.
But as long as the rule exists, we must respond accordingly. I've seen people, like I know most people in Skid Row. I've seen some of those folks shake my hand, give me a hug, and say, Joseph, hey, I got to go to work. And then I'm driving home to the west side of the division, and they're at a blanket, and they're shaking next to the freeway, you know, with a cup in their hand, and they just ate at the midnight mission, you know.
Oh, so they're not really...
They're not really, you know...
Suffering.
They're not really suffering, but they're getting more money to do what? Go destroy themselves with drugs. Now, that's not everybody, but it's far too many. So I'm not okay. telling people to stop helping. Just get to know the person you're giving to first, then you'll find out what their needs are. Don't just flippantly give them money, because for the most part, you're just helping to hurt them.
I think, you know, we all have interesting stories of L.A. When I first moved to L.A., I wanted to help out the homeless, and I got asked to go serve, I think it was Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. to go down to one of the missions and serve downtown. And I happened to have a T-top car, you know, the sunroof kind of car. So I'm getting on the freeway after having served Thanksgiving meal, and a man is at the corner, and he said, hey, lady, do you have any money? And I said, oh, my gosh, you know, young, silly me in my 20s. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh, they're serving meals just down the street at the mission. Mm-hmm. He basically said, F you, lady. My face fell. I'm like,
yeah, you messed up
me.
His fix.
I'm
yeah.
like, F me. Yeah. What did I do?
You messed up everything because he really wanted to go get some drugs.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, once again, that's not everybody, but we have to start. I always tell people, because I have people of faith even argue with me sometimes. They say, well, you know, our word says this. I said, look, you know, we have the wonderful gift of faith. That's a wonderful gift. But you also have to add, we have the gift of wisdom and discernment. I know a wonderful individual named Justin who started a program called One on One. He's from the Wayfair Project. I fell in love with this man and his passion. And he said, Joseph, I got an idea. Instead of just coming down and donating stuff, why don't I find 100 people to adopt one person in Skid Row to get to know, no matter where they are and
wow.
what stage. And we'll get to know them instead of just giving them stuff. And then I said, that's an excellent idea, because when you do get to know them and you gain their trust, like I have with many people in Skid Row, you actually find out what the need is, and then you can help them.
Do you do you really feel like you know everybody on Skid Row?
He does. Let me explain something to you about Dion Joseph.
Okay.
Okay. Dion Joseph.
Officer LAPD.
Officer Dion Joseph. You can turn whatever corner. I don't care what corner you turn at. Somebody knows Officer Dion Joseph.
And the funny thing is, now I'm getting old, so I don't remember names like I used to, but I never forget a face. And, you know, it's just funny, you know, how, you know, I'm wearing the uniform that many people have been indoctrinated to fear and loathe. And I took that. I said, I'm never going to take my uniform off. I'm not ashamed to be an LAPD officer. I'm going to love these people from a place they don't expect, and I'm going to make them love our department by how I treat them. And I love it from me going – I used to get called a whole bunch of names when I first got to Central, and it's some names I can't mention, Uncle T and House N and all that stuff like that. But as the people started seeing my heart, the names started changing. Then I got funny names like Officer Bobblehead, Officer Tight Shirt, and now I love the fact that they call me Dion or Uncle or Goddaddy. When I hear things like that, that means I'm making a difference.
So at first, certain people thought that you were selling out by being in law enforcement as a black man.
It's sad, but I think as a people, we sometimes, now I'm speaking as a black man, we limit our potential to be the change we want to see when we buy into stereotypes and fear-mongering about law enforcement. I always hear it from wonderful advocates who I love to death, and we may disagree. Well, why don't you guys have more African-Americans on the force? I say, well, it's kind of hard when we keep engaging in demagoguery against police officers, you know? So you got
makes
now
you not want to be one.
Makes you not want to be one. So if you really want it, let's do like I did. I didn't want to be a cop. I hated cops when I was a kid.
Oh, and what happened? How'd you go so wrong?
Well, like I said, when I was coming up, we had Dalton Street, we had the Rodney King incident being played every night, and they never showed anything good about my favorite rap groups for NWA, Public Enemy, KRS-One. So yes, F the Police was on my tape deck in rotation. So I was being indoctrinated. Plus, I was racially profiled twice as a young man. I didn't like the feeling. So you never remember the good contacts. You always remember what scars you. So, you know, I was out of work for about, and I'm talking to people, young African-Americans, Latinos, who's thinking about a job. You're out of work right now. You need a good job. I was out of work for 3 months. I was broke. I lost my apartment. It was so disheartening. I put my name in many hats, and one of my friends and an uncle said, hey, put your name in hat for the LAPD. I said, the Rodney King LAPD? Uh-uh. Mm-hmm. And I had no choice. I met a wonderful woman who later became my wife. I wanted to take care of her and give her the world. So I joined the LAPD with a whole lot of reservations, but the only difference that separates me from the African-American community, the rest of my brothers and sisters in the African-American community, is I was brave enough to see the other side. And what I discovered is 90% of everything said about police officers are true. These are human beings doing an incredible job. Are we perfect? No. But, you know, whether they're white, black, Hispanic, I've worked for individuals who really care. And it's sad that when a negative exception of law enforcement, wherever they are in the country, rears their ugly head, you know, it hurts our ability to make those connections and keep people safe. But we really need more people to join the force and stop being afraid. You know, I wouldn't say it if it wasn't true.
So, Colleen, go ahead.
I'm going to piggyback on what he said. I have met, since the time that I've been in Central Division, I have met very wonderful officers, men and women, and they really love helping the homeless. They really do.
So I got to think, though, the person who's committing the crimes, plural, like you talked about them kind of preying on the homeless community, living amongst the homeless community, preying on them. I can't think they love you, do they?
No, many of them don't. But many of them still have my respect, because even though I arrest you, I treat you like a human being. I remember as a young senior lead officer, when I would arrest somebody for selling drugs, or if they were just at their wits' end, they lost their mind and did something horrible, I would put poems in their bag that said, you are not a failure, or talk about living a supernatural life, you know, that you're not a failure, things like that. Or I'd have them plastered on the back seat of my patrol car, and while we're driving, they're looking at it, they may throw up on it, but they get a nice little read. Or then I started getting more, you know, smart about it, and I started putting program information in their bags, and they would come out, and when they got out of jail, they'd remember, yeah, that's the cop that arrested me, but he also tried to help me as well. And so I think the majority of people in Skid Row understand we have a job to do. If you break the law, we're not going to look the other way. This is how I feel about the situation. No one should be above the law. I don't believe rich people should be above the law, because when rich people are above the law, we have Enron, we have scandal, we have stock market crashes, people losing their life savings. That's horrible. I don't think poor people should be above the law, because when we have that, we end up having places like Skid Row, and it exacerbates. Everybody, no one is above the law, but I do also believe that, you know, we can enforce the law with heart. We can infuse services to guide people to services, mandatory services after we arrest you. Give you an alternative to jail and make it mandatory. And that's how I was able to help a lot of people. And our, you know, and also we had a program called SOS years ago where we did just that. We provided alternatives to jail for the homeless people we arrested. You know, if you completed a 21-day program that suited your need, guess what? You know, we rip up the charges if it never existed. And that was a beautiful program. And we lost that, not because we didn't like it, because what happened in 2008, the stock market crash.
So do you feel that, and Colleen, I guess you're echoing this as well, that the majority of the officers in your department, at your division, are walking the same walk with you?
Yeah. I can say that. And I don't wear the uniform like everyone else do, but I have, when people say LAPD is bad, at first, before I got into it, I would kind of like agree with them. But then after I got in there in the Citizen Academy and got to know them more than what I should know them, no, I believe that they walk the walk.
You'll be surprised at what we talk about in the station. We don't just sit around quoting penal codes.
No.
You know, we sit around, talk about the situation. And I was just listening to some young officers, we call them young P2 dogs, and they were just coming up with a plan on how we can make this street safer. And that warmed my heart, because in spite of what we're up against, these officers cared. So here's the difference between me and my fellow officers. We all care. We all want to try to help. This is what I've chosen to do. Because of all the negativity surrounding law enforcement for over the last 10 and 12 years, I said, you know what? I'm going to try to combat this negative and stick my neck out and say, this is what we're trying to do. Because if I don't, someone else is going to tell our story, and it's not going to be right.
Do officers select which division to go to?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of them select. Some of them don't have a choice. They go where their need is. When I was started out, I was in Pacific Division. Palm trees, great eating spots, beautiful women on Sunday afternoon, if you're into that sort of thing.
Pacific is West L.A.
Venice Beach area.
Yeah.
Venice Beach area.
And I was on probation, so they wheeled me out, and I had three choices. I picked a couple of choices, and Central was one of them, not knowing how bad Skid Row was. And when I told my training officer, he says, what did you do? Oh, my God, you got to wear a body condom to work there. The people have needles in their pocket. It's dirty. It's smelly. You're going to catch a disease, and there's no place to eat. And I was like, God, please don't send me to that place. But he had other plans, and I ended up there. And once I saw the plight of the people and just saw real injustice, you know, not what they're manufacturing now, just real tangible injustice on a street level, I couldn't leave them. And that, to me, is just my upbringing and my faith. And there's many cops that's been there for 5, 10, 15 years, and they're still there.
And, you know, let me say this. How should I say this? Most people can say bad things about LAPD, and I would disagree with them. Let me put something to you, okay? When we first started the trust talks, there was people that says, oh, no, they never wanted LAPD to come in the uniforms and stuff like that. I was the one that decided that, yes, they need to come in a uniform, because if you cannot face them in the uniform, you don't need to face them without the uniform. Mm-hmm. And when we first started that trust talk, there's a lot of people that did not want it, but we had it. And I think we just had another one.
We think we had our sixth one, and now the community wants it. And we average about 150 people from various communities, including Skid Row, that come to the Trust Talks. And now the focus is Skid Row. So now we have more people from Skid Row coming to the Trust Talks than people from the Lofts area, which I think is great because that's the area where people have been indoctrinated the most. And sometimes it's just real scars that they had dealing with police officers in the past. But that's the target audience we need to meet with and try to build those bridges with. And we're doing that, I think, better than anyone else in the department.
You talked about the sanitation because if people, again, if you've never been there, it really is tent after tent, block after block. So many people there on the streets. I remember walking by when I went to go see School on Wheels, and I saw a young man drink out a bottle and then urinate in the bottle. So I was like, yeah. Same bottle, okay.
wow.
You and your wife, and I don't know who else, but you do these hygiene kits.
Right.
Talk about the hygiene kits.
The hygiene, I came up with the hygiene kit as a way to educate the public and de-incentivize the streets for the home and guide them the services. So for years, I did it out of my own pocket. And I know I didn't check with the budget queen sometimes, but she got
that's
mad
the
at
missus.
Me. That's the missus.
That's the budget queen.
She would get mad
budget
at me.
Budget queen.
But I would buy products, you know, and put it together. And not only would I put the products in there, hand sanitizer, soap, shaving creams, lotion, I put information in there to help them and guide them to services. And I thought that was a great thing. But what I found over the years that I've had even some officers donate stuff to me. I have an officer I call my secret angel because she never wants me to say her name. She'll donate. I have officers in my station. She said, hey, Joseph, I got these tampons. Can I give them to you? I said, yeah, I need them. So I've been getting a lot of help from my fellow officers and other organizations who've been stepping up and saying, hey, that's a good thing. Let's de-incentivize the street together.
Would that not encourage people to say, okay, you can live on the streets because you have some of the tools that you need?
I would say to a degree, yes. But I would say the difference is you got to understand there's some individuals, because they're addicted to crack cocaine, they'll go 3, 4, 5 days without a shower, binging for the cocaine. So that hygiene kit is gold to them because now they're not wearing their pants are wearing them. And as a result, they feel some kind of way and end up getting into fights because they feel irritated. So that one bag, that shower at a shelter, and that when they feel clean, they feel differently. And then maybe, just maybe, they'll check into a program there. That's the goal. Get them to the program. Hey, take a shower. And then hopefully somebody contacts, hey, you need this, you need that. Because food never did it. I've been invited to drug program graduations where I've never heard anyone graduate and say it was a sandwich in the street that changed my life. But I have heard people thank me for giving me them a hygiene kit, or somebody else for giving them a hygiene kit with information that guided them to services. So does it guarantee that some of that stuff won't end up being sold? No. But there's better chances of them choosing a program. Everything I do is to guide people to hope.
All right. So you are convinced that there are success stories coming out of Skid Row, both of you?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. I'll let you answer
it. Okay. Yes. That was a solid yes. Colleen?
Full yes.
All right. Besides your own story, yes.
Yes.
I would say yes. Now, that's lessened by a degree because of the environment. But when we had Skid Row relatively clean and safe, we had a lot of success stories. As a matter of fact, one of the missions said they used to have a 40% participation rate in their program, and that's low. When things were safe and people were beginning to choose a program, it jumped up to 65%. So, yes, I saw a lot of success stories in Skid Row. But I can tell you now, in this current environment, I'm seeing less and less. It's getting harder and harder.
Well, you're laying out some serious stuff here. And like I said, as a news person, I would normally want to get the other side. Mm-hmm. But since I have you here, mm-hmm. What do you want to see done?
Well, I'll let you answer that first, and then I'll answer.
Okay. What I would like to see done is more mental health, where people can get help. And if they can't get help, they need to find something to where they can talk to somebody and where that person can guide them to counseling.
Well, here's my question. Are you thinking there are people who would say yes to the services if there was more mental health services there?
Probably so, yes. Because the rate that they're going, they're not going to last.
Mm-hmm. For me, there's three things that need to happen. I'll try to keep it brief.
No, first, you can go on.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. First, the laws pertaining to mental health need to change. We can no longer think we're adequately helping anybody in 72 hours or less. That's just a failed policy, a failed premise. because many people, when they haven't taken their medication in a long time, when they finally start taking it, it takes on average 6 to 8 weeks for their medication to actually stabilize them. And then on top of that, you need to detox them. So it shouldn't be 3 days. It should be 6 weeks. The money that's being wasted needs to be put into that as well, okay? On top of that, the cool thing about that is while they're there, the experts are able to develop a rapport with them and find out their names, their loved ones. And what we need to do is make it easier for family members to connect and get conservatorships over them. You know, that's another way. And we need to broaden the definition of what gravely disabled is. I'm sorry, to me, a guy walking down the street with one sock on and a newspaper for a pair of pants, that to me is gravely disabled. But under the definition, current definition, as long as he's able to eat a sandwich and feed himself, then he's fine. That's not right. Okay, so that needs to change like yesterday. The second thing is, I personally believe, we need to decentralize services. And by that, I mean, I don't want to see another program, one program shut down in Skid Row. I just don't want to see another one open up in Skid Row when we have 88 cities in LA County and only three are taking up the mantle of helping the homeless. We need family shelters away from Skid Row. We need shelters for the elderly. And yes, we need housing, but the house first model to me should look like this. Go into the missions and programs and find people who've been clean and sober for 6-8 months and house them first. Because I'm sorry, housing somebody with a needle in their arm and putting them in housing is a disaster waiting to happen, because many of them sadly have drug debts and they owe the loan shark. And when the loan shark finds out they got housing, guess what? They're going to come knocking on the door and say, you owe me money. Here, I need you to turn this hotel out or this low-income housing project out for me.
What's that mean?
That means get everybody hooked on dope. Sell my dope for me in this building. And we have a lot of that in Skid Row, unfortunately.
Oh,
so we have to decentralize where people who leave and go to those places can have a fair chance, and also reduce the population in Skid Row so those people can have a fair chance as well. And then lastly, and I always say this, and I'll never stop saying it, I don't care, stop politicizing away public safety. We are not in Skid Row because people are homeless. We are not doing what we do because people of color, their race. That is not true. We're there because if we're not, people die. And it's that simple. If you take away two officers from Skid Row, the dam will break, as I see it. And that's how violent it's becoming. So you need to let us do our job. We know who the bad guys are, and we know why we're doing it. And it's not to hurt people, but there must be order, yes, even amongst the homeless community.
I was just talking with someone today at a lunch, and I said, you know, about 14 years ago, I was looking to relocate and from Pacific Division, and I was going to look all over LA. I literally looked all over Southern California, and I looked at downtown because I love the buildings of downtown, I love the history of downtown. And I looked at a condo complex where the garage was a separate building, so you'd have to walk from the garage to the building. And I thought, well, I work till midnight, probably a secure garage, but I don't want to be out of my car in a garage or out on the street wherever it was to get to the building at midnight. Yet. Now we see the revitalization of downtown, and it's an amazing. I mean, I had lunch downtown today. It was amazing.
Yep.
You still have a homeless population.
Mm-hmm.
And a woman said to me, it's worse now than 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And it's sadly, it's true. It's true. I said, I remember we had it relatively safe. And once again, now our hands are tied, and it's gone backwards. It's gone basically back to 1997. What's even worse, we're limited in how we can even address it. You know, as we're trying to take a more outreach-driven approach, which I am 100% for, but at the same time, you know, if you give the criminal element in Skid Row 1 inch, they're going to take 10 yards. And I've said this, and I've also said in 2007, as Skid Row goes, so does the rest of Los Angeles. And I haven't been wrong. I want to be wrong. I'm one of those guys who want to be wrong.
Well, when you say that, like I said, I met with these young men, just, you know, last weekend, that I know, that told me they're sleeping, you know, under an ATM at night, sleeping and then getting up and going to work. And I'm like, well, wow, that sure paints a different face of the homeless for me. It's not
right.
Some guy I'm driving by, some strange person. It's
right.
It's you know, somebody I know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I want to answer that because it's not like they have to sleep like that. There's places for men. They'll give them, 3 days meal, whatever, and help them find a job, help them find apartments. LA Mission, Union Rescue Mission.
That's downtown, though.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This area is not downtown. Mm. This is another area. So when you say, you know, the rest of LA goes, mm-hmm. This is the rest of LA.
Well, and that's what this is what I mean by that. See, as Skid Row goes, when there's an approach where, okay, you know, let's just not criminalize people, that's the buzzword they put out there, what happens is the area becomes attractive to other people from other parts of the county, other city, other states, and they send them straight to here. Here's a ticket, go to Skid Row. They got programs here, they're going to solve homelessness, and they come, right? And then the people get here and go, hey, this is not what was in the brochure, and then they get assaulted because they're a new face, and then they retract out to other parts of the city that it's safer to be homeless in. So that's why I say as Skid Row goes, mm-hmm. so does the other, because now you're seeing many Skid Rows pop up all over the city, and it's getting more difficult to help, the situation. Yeah.
Well, I was very moved by this situation where I actually now know somebody, and I am very concerned as to why, the whys. And I know LA is so expensive to be able to get a place. And I agree with you about the organizations that are helping people that are kind of already helping themselves. You know, the working poor, mm-hmm. I think we call it.
Yeah, right? That's really sad. Yeah. And that's a real thing. That's a reality. I said before, there's four groups of people. Everybody in Skid Row is not a crack addict. That's a lie. There are people there who are actually there because of the rise in rent. They can't afford a place to stay. They've lost their housing. They're going through divorces. But I always ask people the question. I said, you know, if you lost your apartment or housing today, like right now, would your first inclination be to set up a tent or a cardboard condo one of the worst places in the United States of America? And everybody I ask that question says, absolutely not. And that's true. Most of them are either sleeping in their cars, or they're trying to find family members, or they're beating down the doors of the shelters to get them and their families in so they don't have to be out in the street, you know. But once again, most of the people that you actually see out in the street have probably been there for years. I've known people who've been sleeping in the streets of Skid Row since 1997. 1997.
And I always wondered how people survive, but you're saying that there are services that offer the meals mm-hmm. that keep you fed.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Places to shower.
Yep.
Yes.
Places to get soap, shampoo.
Yep.
Yep.
Are you saying no excuses?
No excuses at all.
Really?
I believe there are some hindrance for a lot of people, the mentally ill. Some people with criminal elements who I believe need a second chance if they really want it, you know. So there are some hindrance for some, but in the end, you know, I always say rehabilitation, unless you're severely mentally ill, is 100% up to the individual. If a person wants to change, they will. And I've seen that. I've seen that strong few make the choice to change. But it's a choice. It's a choice. And sometimes you need that push. Sometimes some people credit just seeing my ugly face every day saying, hey, you know, you can't sit there. You can't sleep on the sidewalk. You got to stand up. You know, that's what got them to go into a service provider, because they got sick of looking at me. And guess what? Now they're clean and sober.
Do you feel there is enough mission space? There's enough housing? I mean, because I think of the Downtown Women's Center and thinking, well, these women can live here and have their own beautiful apartment. It's a, you know, rebuilt building. It's, you know, great services. Who wouldn't want to go there?
There are nights where there are beds available, but for the most part, they're few and far between. And that's a problem that needs to be addressed. That's why I say stop the NIMBYism and open up shelters in other places. But there are some people, like I said, it's like they get used to the street life, and there's a twisted sense of freedom that says mm-hmm. I can smoke my drugs here, and you know there's no consequences to it. I can't go into the program and smoke drugs because, like I said, it's a program. I can't bring my gun. I can't bring my this and or my means of protection. And there are people there who will just get used to. Look, you have people that camp for fun. They literally go camping at campsites just for fun. I always say a human being can get used to anything, even something that's bad for them. You know, like I said, I know people who go back to war because they like the camaraderie. War is hell. They'll tell you that. You know, I know people that would get out of prison and then see how hard life is on the outside, and they'll commit a crime just to go back so they can have three hots and a cot and some health care. You know, so if you allow a human being to get used to that environment, sadly, many of them will stay. As a matter of fact, I have the 3-day rule. There are individuals who come into Skid Row, they lose everything, and the first day they're terrified. They're like, their eyes like, what is this place? Oh my God, I got to get out of here. And if they can't get connected soon enough, that second day they get really stressed out. And it's like, oh my God, I can't take it. Now they need to escape. And that third day, they start binging on drugs again to escape, you know, the trauma of what they're seeing. And next thing you know, they're stuck for 3, 4, 5 years. And I want to create an environment where people can't get stuck. Let's get you to services as quickly as possible, you know. And that's the reality of it.
Mm. Wow. This is powerful. Colleen?
Yeah. Like he was saying, Dion, I had met a family, I think it was last year, and it was, they came from, I think, Chile or Mexico, I think it was. And I met them at School on Wheels. And the little boy, he was looking for, well, the mother didn't know where School Wheels was. And so I finally met up with her. Oh, my God, when I did, she was right there on Los Angeles Street with her and her husband, got their truck, opened up the truck, got their tent, and went to sleep right over there. And I'm like, Union Rescue Mission's down the street. Do you want me to help you get into the mission? And the man says, no, I don't want to be in the mission.
Because?
Because he said he don't want to follow their rules.
Yeah. I just interviewed some homeless veterans who've gotten off the streets. We did a segment with New Directions for Veterans. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They're at the VA property.
I haven't heard of them, but yeah, we do know a lot of veterans out there. Yeah.
Right. So the two men that they brought, who are their success stories today, they've been with the program just about a year. They're telling me, painting a very vivid picture as to why they stayed on the streets. One said he was an addict. He finally decided for his daughter he was going to change his life. The other one now has a job. He said he was, I was just the very sweet, friendly, homeless guy. I kind of kept to myself. But it amazed me, like you said, that people can find a comfort in something like that. And he said somebody dragged him, said, let's go.
That's good. I like what you said. The key word, two words you said, he decided, she decided. It's a choice. Now, there are many people. I'm not saying that, hey, people are just going to magically pop up and get housing the next day. That doesn't work like that. But if you do the work, I've seen it where people, no matter how hard it is, they fight for their life. And I know many success stories that many officers were a part of, myself. I remember I had seven officers. I had the Old Blue Detail. It was a program I created so it could be someone other than me engaged in community policing. And I found seven officers who loved working Skid Row, who loved the people just like I did. And they took a big old sandwich truck and parked in the worst parts of Skid Row. And they got out there and they passed the hygiene kits, talked to people, and the people started trusting them and giving them crime information. And, hey, I need drug programs. They started putting people in shelter, kids in shelters. So, it's not just me. It's just a lot of officers just don't like talking about it. Like I said, I talk about it because if I don't, someone else is going to tell our story. And I'm tired of that because it's a false narrative.
And you don't worry yourself about illness or disease or sanitation issues?
It's so funny because when I was at Venice Beach, I was a germaphobe. I would wear five gloves to search people. And then I got to Skid Row and I was like, oh, my God, I need 10 gloves. But, I'm a man of faith. And I'm not apostolizing, but there's a saying in my household that the good Lord doesn't give up on people, neither shall we. And I always took that to heart. And after I realized I was home, I just couldn't leave. I couldn't leave. And I'm not afraid anymore. I've never caught one disease other than pink eye a couple of times. And there's been some scares. We've had a tuberculosis scare, hepatitis scare. We have a typhus scare. And I just feel like I feel in my heart I'm being protected from up above from a lot of this stuff. So I have no fear. I don't mind hugging somebody who's dirty or smelly. To me, they need to feel that love from a place they've been taught not to expect it. It's important to make it.
Is that how you got the name Angel of Skid Row?
I guess so.
That's where it came from. Colleen, what's your hope as we kind of bring this to a close? What is your hope for Skid Row and the people who live there? And I say emphasis on people. Who live there?
My hope and dreams are is that we get a lot of help with mental health. Make sure mothers, fathers, kids, whoever has a mental health problem, have someone to talk to go to, and to have more strength to find a place to stay.
And you've never thought of, okay, my work is done. I'm going to go rest.
No.
A lot of work to be done.
There's a lot of work down there to be done.
Yes, it is.
And your kids, they're all cool with this?
they don't have no problem with me doing it.
Mm-hmm. Have they been inspired, motivated by it?
Yeah. Because they always wonder what the next thing I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's she up to now?
Yeah.
Wow, how motivational.
Mm-hmm.
And you credit meeting this officer?
Yeah.
This is the power of the picture of, yeah, I like what Colleen said, there's no excuses. You can make a difference. You don't have to be rich. You don't have to be a politician. You don't have to be a celebrity. You can be on the level of somebody and lift people up, you know? And that's what I love about my job and seeing inspirational people like Colleen and so many others. There's so many others, not just Colleen. But Colleen is just an exceptional example of the power of the human spirit and soul. And that's why I love this job. I hope they don't kick me out of Skid Row anytime soon.
How long have you been an LAPD officer?
24 years, man.
How long do you think you stay?
I got about 6 years left, but I feel my heart is guiding me somewhere else. I'm not sure where, because I know with us being handcuffed the way we are, I think we're limited in how we can. But until that happens, I'm still going to be in Skid Row until they throw me out of there. So.
Well, okay. On my podcast, Olympic and Bundy, my guests have been Dion Joseph, LAPD officer, and Colleen Granderson, who works now with the LAPD after having been in the Skid Row area herself. I think your stories are so powerful. Let's just clone you two.
That wouldn't the world be a beautiful place.
Let's create an army of the two of you. Would that be okay?
What a cool world.
Yeah. So it's my honor to meet with you. And like I said, if you remember, Officer, when I saw you at that event, I came running over to get my picture with you.
Oh, yeah.
And I was so grateful that even Fox 11 was allowed to tell your story even for a short amount of time. And then today we had this full amount. Is there something I haven't asked yet that I need to be asking?
No, I think we covered everything, and I just thank you for the opportunity to share our hearts and for me to also share the hearts of the officers I work with. Like I said, there's good and bad in everything. The vast majority of officers working in our department really care. There's a negative exception in every profession, but you know, you can count on the fact that the vast majority of us out there are doing a tough job as human beings, and you know, give them some love there.
I just feel like we should give your wife a shout out, because she is a beautiful part of this journey too.
I got to give my baby a shout out. You know, my chocolate boo boo thing out there in Los Angeles. Out there.
And what's her name?
Tasha Joseph. And she has been the rock. She's held me up. You know, a lot of people don't have that shoulder to cry on, that person to just bounce stuff off of. But she has made herself available to me for that. And also, she doesn't worry about me. She feels the same way I do, like something's protecting me, so I don't worry. I'm able to go do my job freely, and she loves me and appreciates me. And God, baby, I love you wherever you are.
Well, I love that the event we did together.
Oh, we love Tasha.
Yeah?
Tasha Joseph, we love you.
I love that, too. Well, I remember seeing, I had a chance to MC a law enforcement thing on a Sunday, and looking out, seeing where you were honored, you and your wife and your children, your boys were there.
Oh, man, my boys, the three greatest gifts from God I ever had.
That was, I mean, for them to see that and be part of that,
because
I thought was really special. And, you know, what nugget they're going to take away from your journey, I bet you can't wait to see.
I cannot wait to see what they become. I don't need them to be cops. If they are, fine, but wherever they go, I just pray that they make impact wherever they go.
Well, I mean, how can they not? They've been touched by this message.
All right.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
To go back to work, right?
Yes, I do.
Well, we should get you out of here.
All right.
Work to do on these streets of LA. Thanks, everyone, for being on the podcast, Olympic and Bundy. You can find this podcast wherever you find your podcast. And I like to empower people as well. I want to thank the person who contributed the music, and that is DJ Reaper. We close it out.